Session number 11357.
Harry Clark, Reel 3.
On the eastern bank of the River Orne, there were five other parachute battalions, so we were well protected from that direction. Our only worries at the moment were to wondering when the German counterattack would come in force, because this was when the real battle would commence. But fortunately, up till lunchtime, the 7th took the bulk of it. They put up a tremendous fight, and I can't say enough in praise of those chaps. They were taking the brunt of the Germans from the west, and they did a magnificent job in holding them off. Meantime, we on the bridges, we were getting the sniper fire, we were taking a few casualties, but at least we were able to get into the trenches and relax. I sat down by the side of the big pill box, which today forms the foundation of a house. The pill box itself is still there. I sat by the side of that with the wireless set receiving messages and passing them on. I had a fairly comfortable morning, quite frankly. And time went by. On two occasions, I went across the bridge with Sergeant Godbold. We ran like the devil because someone rumoured that there was champagne going for free. So we nipped over the bridges and we had a glass of champagne and we ran like hell back to our position. And all in all, I had a fairly quiet day myself on the morning of D-Day. It was towards 1 o'clock that the word went round that the commandos were in the vicinity. And it was nice where I was. I had an excellent view of the bridge. I was only a matter of yards away from the eastern end of the Pegasus Bridge. And I sat there with the pillbox and I watched the first of the commandos come over. I saw the piper, who I now know to be Bill Millin, who was Lord Lovett's piper. And I saw Lord Lovett stroll across as though he was taking a Sunday afternoon stroll. And I was amazed by the courage of the man, because some of his commandos were being shot at and killed by the snipers. But I was amazed at the man's courage. It left me wondering. And it was lovely to see all these commandos coming across the bridge and moving forward towards the village of Ranville, where they were to form a protective screen and take over positions from some of our chaps. I believe some of them were going to move down and take over from the 9th Para Battalion, who'd done the attack on the Merville Battery. And I believe that they lost a fair number of men on that attack and they needed some relief. But from the rest of the afternoon, apart from this sniper fire, until rumours went around about 8 o'clock in the evening that the seaborne troops were now coming forward. I believe they were members of the 3rd British Infantry Division. But we hadn't seen any sign of them. We'd seen one or two British Sherman tanks cross the bridge, but mainly it had been the commando brigade that went over. The dusk then began to fall, and things were definitely much quieter in the area of the bridges. I would think it would be about 9 o'clock that the 7th Para Battalion began to move off across the bridges, so they had obviously been relieved by some British infantry. And we just sat, and it was shortly after this that the glider landings destined for the evening began to take place. Some gliders containing the Royal Ulster Rifles and support troops, the various Royal Engineers, Royal Army Medical Corps people, they landed around the villages of Ronville and in that area. The remainder of our battalion, which consisted of A Company, B Company and C Company headquarters, began to land on the west side of the bridge. It was a wonderful sight to see these chaps coming in, because it was going to add quite a few thousand more troops to back us up. And it would have been about 11 o'clock at night, I think, when we began to see the troops of our own battalion, 2nd Battalion Oxford and Bucks, begin to cross the bridge and move forward towards the village of Ronville. We as a company stayed on the bridges, still guarding the bridges, which we now regarded as our own. And we didn't want to leave there because we were so happy there. And we sat there, I would think, till shortly after midnight, when a battalion of the 3rd Division, I believe it was the 8th Battalion of the Warwickshire Regiment, troops of that battalion came along and relieved us at the bridge. We started to pack up, and then we moved off in the direction of Ronville to seek out the rest of the battalion.
We were discussing earlier about the inaccuracies which have been appeared in print about Pegasus Bridge. Would you like to put right any of those you can think of?
Well, certainly the timing of the landing of the gliders, I think, is in error. From research I have done, from my own recollections, from the debriefing of the aircraft pilots and speaking to glider pilots, I think that to say that we landed at approximately 25 minutes past midnight would be more accurate. The landing of the gliders, the positioning of the gliders, I think the actual landing of the gliders, there is no doubt that the first glider landed, 25 platoon glider landed, that's the one close to the bridge. 24 platoon glider landed in the 3rd position, and 14 platoon glider landed in the middle. I think that this is accurate. I've spoken to glider pilots. I've looked at photographs, and from my own estimations of the state of the wreckage of the glider I took aim out of, I am completely certain that 24 glider landed in the 3rd position, and that the tablets, the memorial tablets, are inaccurate. Full stop.
And the other thing was about the accusation about the prisoner being frog marched.
Well, I took the prisoner to the cage at Ronville, to 5th Para Brigade Headquarters cage at Ronville, and I did not frog march a prisoner. There is no way that I could have frog marched a prisoner. And that is definitely inaccurate.
Now, you were telling me that about the battle at Escoville. Can you tell me about that now?
Yes, I can certainly throw some light on that. When we joined the battalion at Ronville, it took some time to find them, and it was well into the early hours of the 7th of June before we located them. We finally spent a very rough couple of hours in a copse somewhere on the outskirts of Ronville. A most uncomfortable night. I was expecting to be given some more ammunition, etc., but we didn't receive any. I don't know what went wrong, whether it was just our section or platoon that was left out, but we did not receive any more ammunition, and we spent a fairly rough couple of hours trying to get some sleep in a damp copse. The battle was still raging all around, but Ronville itself was reasonably quiet. So we did manage to snatch a little bit of sleep, but not a lot, not more than an hour. I would think sometime in the very, very early hours of the 7th, we were woken up and we were told that we were going to advance to a village called Heruvalet. I can recall going out along a little footpath, a well-worn footpath, and passing a series of chaps wrapped in blankets, and I thought, lucky beggars. And it wasn't till I got to the top of the rise that I realised that they were casualties, they were dead from the previous day's attack. I think all in all I counted 17. And knowing that we were going to move forward for an attack, this didn't do much for my courage. Anyway, we advanced to Ronville without any opposition. I tell a lie there, we advanced to Heruvalet without any opposition. And then we took, from Heruvalet, we seemed to take to a track that led up to the chateau at Escaville. As we moved forward, I'm still not too sure of the time. I would think at that time it would be about 8 o'clock in the morning. As we moved forward along this track going to the chateau, we came under very, very heavy shell fire from, I would think it was a self-propelled gun somewhere to our right. And I can recall laying down in a wooded area and trying to burrow deeper into the ground as each shell burst went off. Eventually it stopped and we moved forward again. And we were there for some little time actually before we moved forward. And there was still some desultory type of shell fire going. It may have been mortar fire and small arms fire. But eventually we began to move forward into Escaville itself. Now we got into the fringes of Escaville and took up a position on the edge of the village, the edge of the village that led back to Heruvalet. And there we stayed again for some time. Corporal Godbold suddenly came up and said, we're going to move forward now. And we came out onto a road, farm buildings and houses. There was quite a heavy amount of sniper fire falling down on us, and we took one or two casualties. I can recall seeing Major Howard leaning against a wall, crouched down. He had a bandage round his head. And word went round that a sniper had got him, and obviously it was a true story, because in the Airborne Forces Museum at Bienville, you can see his steel helmet with a hole right through it. So he must have been dazed and put out, concussed for some time. Anyway, we finally moved round, turned at a T-junction and formed a defensive position. This is 24 platoon. We formed a defensive position around this T-junction. Now, there was a road out there going south-southwest. At this T-junction, I can recall helping to get Bob Ambrose, from 22 platoon. He'd been shot in the leg or wounded in the leg in some way. We got him under cover in a big old barn that stood there and went back to the section then, and Claude Godbold said to me, "Can you go forward, Nobby?" He said, "I want you to try and establish a link with 22 platoon." So I said, "What, by myself?" Because they were about 200 yards up the road. He said, "No." He said, "Take Ginger Radford, Private Ginger Radford, with you." So I said, "Well, fair enough." I said, "Don't fancy it, though." And I said, "It's a bit nasty up there. You know, I could hear a few shots going on up there." And he said, "Well," he said, "you go forward," he said, "and Ginger Radford can follow you about 20 yards behind." So we got into a ditch and crouched down. We moved forward very slowly, and the road was under very, very accurate sniper fire. If you poked your head up, I think it would have been a certain death, because the chap was very accurate. We went forward and we made contact with 22 platoon. That was Lieutenant Hooper's platoon, and they were at the far end of the road, about 200 yards ahead, on a very, very sharpish sort of bend. And I saw one or two of my friends there, Jimmy St. Clair from Dagenham, and I gave him a shout and a wave, and there were several other chaps on the other side of the ditch, on the other, who I knew. And before we had a chance of getting established in any way, we heard the rattle of a machine gun, the sound of treaded vehicles approaching, and before we could even look up, a medium tank came round the corner, followed by masses of German infantry. At first we were thrown, because they looked so much like our own tank, this particular one, and someone said, it's the airborne recce force. No sooner was that said than firing broke all out around, and we knew that they were Germans. At this time, this tank, the leading tank, there were two of them, was about 25 yards away from me. I was in a fairly deepish ditch, and I thought, well, this is it. I've got to get back to the platoon. And I pulled out a 77 smoke grenade, phosphorus grenade, and I threw it in the direction of the tank. And that is the last thing I recall there, because I came to much later in the day. I have no knowledge of an explosion. I have no knowledge. All I can recall is that I threw a grenade at this tank, a smoke grenade, in the direction of the tank, and that is the last thing I remember. I came to much later in the afternoon. I was all alone. I was laying in the ditch, and I thought to myself, what a bloody silly thing to do, fall asleep in the middle of a battle. And I stood up. And as I stood up, I became aware of an intense pain in my eardrum, my left ear, and I was dizzy as old Nick. And it came to me then that something obviously had been fired, whether it was grenade, rocket, shell, I don't know. There was nobody with me. I could see one body in the road ahead of me. And I was alone, and I was frightened. I could hear the tanks. I could hear tanks on the road behind me in the village of Eskerville. And from my somewhat scattered thoughts, I deduce that whatever happens, I mustn't go backwards, back to the village. So I got up out of the ditch, and I staggered. I must have staggered because I was on the left-hand side of the road one minute and the right-hand side the next. And I found a small house or bungalow cottage on the right-hand side of the road. I went to the front door and I opened it. I went inside and I went unconscious again. I sat down and I was unconscious. God knows how long I was out. I just haven't got a clue. But eventually I came to and I felt quite okay. The dizziness had gone. I still had the pain in my ear. And I went to the window and peeped out of the curtains, you know, without touching them. And I could see no sign of life at all, but I could still hear the tanks in the village. And there were definitely foreign voices, whether they were French or German, I can't say. But the sound really echoed. There was no sound of battle at all, you know, it had all died out. So I waited a bit longer, and I finally went to the rear side of the house, that is the side facing away from the village of Eskerville, facing southwards. And I opened the window, drew the curtains and opened the window, and I climbed out into the back garden and made for a very tall hedge that was just a few yards away. One of these typical French Normandy hedges, very, very tall, very, very thick. And I got down on my hands and knees and I crawled along it, and suddenly 200 or 300 yards along this I heard whispered voices, and I thought, oh God, I've run into them. And I suddenly realised that they were speaking in English. And I crawled along a bit further and thought, well, I better not go too close in case they shoot me. And I called out, are you D Company? And a voice said, yes, we're D Company. And I crawled round the corner, around a bend in the edge. Well, it wasn't a bend, it was a bush, a projecting bush actually. And there were three of my mates from, there was Private Clive, Private Morgan, and I can't think of the name of the third chap. Oh, George Waite, Private George Waite. Three chaps. I think, I've got a feeling they were 22 platoon people. And I was so relieved to see them. And I think they were relieved to see me. And I said, what's happened? And they said, well, most of our platoon has gone, they said. They've been knocked out and killed on the bend in the road there. And we sat down and had a whispered conversation as to what we should do, what would be best. And I mentioned about the tanks in the village, and I said I thought that the Germans had got control of the village. And so we decided from the position of the sun, and that was sinking well into the sky by then, into the west, that we'd better move in a northerly type of direction, which we did. We went along this hedge, and somewhere we crossed through the hedge onto the other side to keep ourselves the hedge between us and the village. Well, we went along a few hundred yards, I suppose, and suddenly I looked up across to the right. Something drew my attention, and there was a ruddy great German tank there about 150 yards off, surrounded by the crew. Fortunately, they were all outside the tank. And I shouted, for Christ's sake, get over the other side of the hedge. And to this day, we got, it was a tall hedge, and it must have been 8 foot high, almost as high as this room. How we got through that hedge, I'll never know. We may have jumped over it, we may have gone through it, but we were through on the other side and into a bit of a ditch where we ran like blazes for probably a quarter of a mile, till we were out of breath, you know. And then we got into a ditch alongside the hedge and settled down and got our breath back. I'll switch off a bit. Well, we proceeded along, keeping the hedgerows, keeping close to the hedgerows, because we were now certain that we were behind the enemy lines. And we wandered on until dusk began to fall, and we came across this forest where we were in a forest, and we put Clive in charge because he was a big country lad, and we, you know, knowing the ways of countrymen, we thought he would have a better sense of direction than any of us. And eventually we came out. No, the first night we slept in a bit of a copse of bushes in the forest. There were sounds of movement all around us. We assumed, for safety's sake, that all movement was German. So we took it in turns to get our heads down and have a few minutes sleep. And then we'd wake up and let somebody else have a sleep. Two of us slept and two of us were awake. And this went right through the night. The following morning, as soon as it was dawn, we started moving again. And we carried on. We stayed in the forest. God knows how deep we were in the forest. And we carried on walking. Eventually, we came to a bit of a track. So we said, well, we'll follow this track, but we'll keep inside the forest. We won't actually walk on the track, because if there's any Germans around, they'll have it covered. So we carried on down the track in what we thought was a sort of a north-northwesterly direction. And eventually we came to a farm, a big farmhouse by the side of the track. There was a house and there was a big barn there. And we said, well, let's do a recce of this place. We went right round it on three sides. We didn't go on the side facing the track. And eventually we went over a little fence and made our way to the barn, where we got in the barn, shut the doors. There was no sign of life within the barn, no sign of life within the farmhouse, although we didn't actually go inside. And we said, well, we're going to lay up here now for the day and see what happens, see what's going on. And there was a huge barrel in there. It must have been 8 to 10 foot high and probably just as long. It was, and a tap on it, and we tapped it, and it was full of very, very rough cider. And then we realised that we were in the area where they make the calvados from apple brandy, whatever they call it. And there were one or two bottles actually filled with the distillation of the cider, and it was vile stuff. We had a swig of it, but it was horrible to drink. We had no, apart from our little bits and pieces, we had a few bits of ration left over, but we couldn't make any tea because nobody